We're going to the parking lot while everyone else is at the game.
Guys, I really can't stand heights. So don't look down, keep your eyes closed, we'll lead you. No thanks.
Fine, see you later. Let's go.
Guys!
Don't worry, he'll come.
Guys! Wait,
he'll come. See, I told you.
On the ocean anymore. Let's learn to enjoy motorboating.
It is very nice.
Hop in. Have a seat.
It's really nice. Nice upholstery. It looks like something the Great Gatsby would ride around in. cabin?
Dad, can I see her?
No, you're in the back.
Honey, we're not going out.
Sure, why not?
Let's go!
Marvin!
Just for a short spin.
It's getting dark.
There's light enough. It'll just be very short. Nikki, you can cast us off.
But you're a cloud. It could be raining soon.
We won't even leave the marina. You gotta see how this thing motors.
All right, but just a short one. It's lovely mahogany.
I like the steering wheel.
Who's going to varnish it? Not me, I hope.
Huh, it was working fine this afternoon. Fine this afternoon.
Hooray!
There. Wait, Nikki, don't cast off.
I'm sorry.
I wasn't ready for you to. Oh, great. I gotta get this thing going.
We're floating out from the dock. What do you want me to do?
Nothing. Just hold the baby. I think I know what's causing it.
Floating out, Dad.
We are, honey.
And let Nikki hold the baby. Here's a paddle. You can get us over to the dock. Baby condensation in the line. Spark plugs are brand new.
I don't seem to be making any headway. Honey, we're just going in circles.
We're also floating out.
All right. Never mind that. And never mind this either. I'll use the spare outboard.
Get us back over to the dock. Cindy, reach under the console where you're sitting. Feel a lever. Switch it to the right.
To the right?
That's right. Okay.
Great.
Daddy, we're still floating out.
I know we're floating out.
There's quite a current, Marvin. We're really drifting.
I'm going to try the engine again. Switch that lever back to the left. I don't get it. It was running perfectly this afternoon.
Hey, Dad, we don't need the motor. We're moving fine without it.
Honey?
The little girl is right. Things are moving along quite rapidly. In fact, on this particular night, quite a number of events have been set in motion, each and every one of them crucial to what is about to happen. Each and every one of them pointing toward a rendezvous with danger. Tonight, Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater moves inland to the Ohio River to present an original suspense thriller entitled Danger at 7 Mile Bend. Yes, there were many things conspiring that night, but there were four big ones you could point your finger at and say they definitely were the cause. The rain, the flare, the boat, and the barge. The rain first. The irony is not a single drop ever fell on Cincinnati. It all came out of a band of fast-moving thunderstorms sweeping across central Ohio, fast until it met up with another frontal system and that made it stall. For hours it hovered and rained. Not just rained, poured. It was early June. After a wet spring, there had been almost 4 weeks of no rain. Crops were up, but not very tall. There was still plenty of topsoil in the fields and on the exposed hillsides where the new housing developments were going in. The soil had turned hard, so when raindrops fell, trillions of them, the tendency was to run off, not soak in. Within the first 30 minutes, half the droplets falling had found their way into rivulets, flowing, merging with larger streams, gathering speed, finally pouring like a frothy avalanche. The muddy water came down, carrying with it logs, silt, and uprooted trees. The deluge continued, pouring into feeder tributaries like 3 Mile Creek, 5 Mile Creek, and the Little Miami River. Logs and trees jammed up at the mouth until, with an even greater onrush of water, they broke loose and were swept out into the wide current of the Ohio. In the river, the logs looked like alligators at the surface. The uprooted trees, with their tangled roots exposed, were like the heads of Medusa. An amazing flood, yet more amazing because just south of it all, in Cincinnati, not one drop of water was falling. That was the role the rain played. But, as I say, it was only one factor in the numerous frightening things all occurring about the same time. But why let me tell it? Why not hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak? After all, if you wanted to know what it feels like to ride over Niagara Falls in a barrel, much better to hear it from someone who did. Except in Jeb Hardy's case, what happened to him was not quite like riding over Niagara Falls in a barrel. It was more like having Niagara Falls ride over you.
I was lying there, fitfully dozing, when the nurse shook me on the wrist.
Mr. Hardy, are you awake?
I thought she was waking me up to give me another pain pill. They do that here. but it wasn't that. Not this time.
There's an attorney here to see you.
Who is it?
From your company. Shall I say you're not up to it?
No, I'd better. Sit me up, will you? How does this work?
I'll do it. Excuse me, just a minute, please.
It's all right. I'm up to it.
Are you sure?
Come in, have a seat.
All right now, not too long.
Thank you, nurse.
I'm Claire Knight.
Jeb Hardy.
I'm the company's legal representative. The company is anxious to take a statement from you. We don't want to rush you, though. We know you're recuperating.
Is all this going to mean my license?
That will be up to the Coast Guard.
You're trying to affix blame?
That will be up to an administrative law judge.
So what's this for, then?
The company wants to assess its liability. It's not just us, I'm afraid. The insurance company, the Coast Guard, the National Transportation Safety Board, they're all interested in this one.
And the company will use my statement to decide if they're going to hire me, fire me, or what? Sue me?
Would you like to have your own attorney present?
I guess not. Not unless he was there, too. I can explain what happened. But if I'm going to make a statement, I have one condition.
What?
I want it complete. I don't want to be taken out of context.
All right.
I've got to have a chance to tell the whole thing. If somebody's going to take away my license, I want them to know what it is they're taking away.
I understand.
Who else have you spoken to?
I spoke with Mr. Buell.
What does he say?
That you panicked. That you abandoned the wheelhouse. Failure to take charge, failure to assess danger, failure to assume responsibility, not showing proper judgment, failure to take necessary precautions, turning over control of the wheelhouse to an unqualified person.
That's a joke.
Imperiling the safety of the public, risking environmental catastrophe. That's about it.
I might have expected him to say all that.
I also spoke with your nephew. He claims you didn't panic.
Yeah, well, I might have expected that, too. The kid idolizes me.
As a general rule, idols don't remain idols for long once they're seen to panic. You still seem to be firmly up on his pedestal. I brought a tape recorder. Is that all right?
I guess. Luke's only 9. Already he thinks he knows he wants to be a river pilot. I was slightly older when it happened to me. Maybe 10 or 11.
Tell me about it.
You really want me to go all the way back?
You said you didn't want to be taken out of context.
All right. I was born and grew up on the Ohio River. Gallia County, near Gallipolis. My parents weren't river people, though, far from it. My father's family came out of the hills, coal mining, moonshining. Then he took up horse breeding in an effort to improve his station in life. Blue grass aiming at blue blood, I suppose. I was small for my age, and it was his dream that I'd become a jockey. That was a dream I grew out of, literally. After that came my mother's secret aspiration. She was sort of religiously bent. I should say her bent was religion. She was big in the Baptist church, and her dream for me was to become a minister. I've always been cursed with youthful looks bordering on angelic. It hasn't made piloting easier. And my mother thought these features would be perfect set off by a clerical collar. She also said I was much more philosophical-minded than other boys my age. She laid the groundwork for this coming true by arranging to have me baptized. A second time. I had had this done once before, apparently as an infant, but she decided it wouldn't hurt to do it again. It might take better this time. One Sunday, without forewarning, she woke me up before sunrise and laid out a brand new suit of clothes I was to put on. She was waiting for me in the car. She wouldn't tell me where we were going. She was definitely letting the drama build up. I was surprised when we drove past the church. Then we headed for the river. We drove down a long, straight road. I could see a patch of the river up ahead through the trees. I could see people from the church waiting there. I knew something momentous was about to take place, but I still had no idea I was the central figure. People were extra nice to me, though, fussing, patting me on the head. The minister was there, dressed in church robes, all clean and unspoiled. He called me to come by him. Then he took me by the hand and with a firm grip walked me straight out into the river. We waded out waist deep, his waist, which meant the water was up to my chest. At first I held my arms up, but then figured why bother and let him drop. It wasn't cold. In fact, the water felt warmer than the air, but I was shaking like a leaf, scared, everything so bizarre. The minister was saying things, some sort of invocation that had a lot of seriousness to it, but it was all going right over my head. I was too shook up, too distracted. I looked back on shore. Everybody was smiling, everyone except my mother, who was crying and smiling. I have to admit, I felt a kind of stirring inside me, some sense of awe that might have been connected to the river itself. I looked out at the mist rising off the water, the sunlight touching the tops of the trees on the opposite bank. I listened to the birds waking up. The minister wound up what he was saying. With a Hosanna blessing from the congregation, he put his hand on top of my head and firmly pushed me under. He dunked me. They were all hoping I would come up a Christian. Instead, I popped up a river man. It wasn't long before I had my first ride on a towboat. It wasn't long before I was wading in the river again. I was out walking late one night through a wooded stretch that ran along the shore. I came across one. It was almost like I had stumbled upon its lair. It was lying up against the bank in the shallows like a large fish. There was a dense fog. The captain had his searchlight switched on and aimed forward. A long, tapering cone of blue light. It looked like smoke, an illusion created by the fog drifting through it. There was nobody visible on deck. Faintly, I could hear workers way up forward. Suddenly, while I was standing there, the searchlight swung and began traveling up the shoreline towards me. Was it heading for me, hunting me? I almost ran, but then it stopped, about 10 feet away, and fastened on a big sycamore. Then I realized he was using the tree as a benchmark, checking to see if he was drifting out or down with the current. They were waiting out the fog. Were waiting for something out there. Possibly another tow to pass by. I had a sudden, enormous urge to hop on. The towboat was only 12 feet off the bank. I wouldn't have to swim more than 2 strokes. I couldn't hop on the barges. He was pushing empties, and they were riding too high. But the bottom deck of the towboat, the work deck, was right at the waterline. No railing, only a chain to grab onto if you slipped. I could slide under that. I began taking off my clothes and rolling them in a ball. It was a dumb, stupid thing to do, and deadly foolish. Hopping a tow is like hopping a freight train. For a few moments there, I was just relying that the captain wasn't going to choose that particular time to start up again. If he did, I'd be sucked under, chopped up by the propellers. When he did, thank God I was already off. I managed to sneak my way forward all the way out to the lead barge. I found an out-of-the-way corner and rode the whole night. In the morning, I was discovered before I could disembark. They put me off at a lock, threatening the law, but they also gave me phone money. I was undaunted, though. I knew I'd find a way to get right back on. You take a certain kind of cat. Doesn't matter how many times you throw him off your lap, he's going to keep jumping right back up. By then, I knew what I was jumping for. I enrolled in the river school in Memphis, got my basic operator's license, began studying right away for my master's. It is said there is only one thing you need to know for a master's pilot license, and that's everything. I made it through, becoming one of the youngest pilots ever certified, certainly the youngest looking. Just having a master's license didn't guarantee me a job. There were no companies hiring, no berths available. My age was a factor, I think. I began working as a tripper, a hired gun, and I will say this, it gave me experience. Once I met an airline pilot who told me after every trip he took, he would stick pins in a globe and connect them by a strand of yarn. He had been so many places, his globe was beginning to look like a solid ball of yarn. My globe would look different. My globe would look like a big, bald thing wearing a wool necktie. Finally, about a month and a half ago, I got a break. Intercoastal Guardian, a transport outfit, said they would be willing to consider me for a pilot's post. It wasn't exactly a captain's berth, but it was a good step up. Conditional, though. 30 days. After that, if they liked me, if I liked them, we could make it permanent. Fine, I said. So, I did my 30, then began 30 days off. I was waiting for a phone call or a letter. About a week went by. I began looking after my nephew, Luke, because my sister was in the hospital about to have her second when the phone call came. It wasn't what I was expecting. They wanted me to make one more run. Go to Kansas City on the Missouri River, pick up a load of Western coal, deliver it down the Mississippi and upstream on the Ohio to a power plant just above Cincinnati. I could have said no. I wasn't about to. The problem was Luke, who I still had to look after. The company thought about it, said, never mind, I could bring him along. I figured it meant they were swamped with too many orders and not enough pilots. I didn't realize it was something more ulterior. And nobody informed me anything about it until I got there. I was about to be subjected to the Silas Buell towboat driver's test. The Nancy M. was waiting for us at Kansas City Harbor. She was 175 feet, mostly white, with blue trim and rows of yellow work lights strung party fashion along the lower decks. The bottom deck was flush to the waterline, each deck up progressively smaller, until the pilot house was just a cube on top. I glanced up there and caught a glimpse of a bony white head in the window. My first view of Silas Buell. The first meeting came shortly thereafter.
This is Mr. Dick Swain. This is Mr. Mark Fulmer.
Hi, nice to meet you. Jeff Hardy.
On this run, Mr. Hardy, you and I will take the forward watch. Mr. Swain and Mr. Fulmer will handle the after watch.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, Captain.
No, don't call me Captain. Call him. This voyage, Mr. Hardy has that designation. Mr. Hardy is being evaluated for employment. I intend to see how he handles himself.
Neither Pullman nor Swain looked like they envied my sudden promotion. In fact, I'm sure they were both relieved to be working a shift separate from the old man. Silas Buell was gaunt, gray-faced and bony-knuckled. Age had made him stooped, shoulders pulled up, so to look straight ahead, he had to lift his chin. It made him look like a vulture. In his case, entirely justified. His beady eyes were sunk back in his head, but only one of them was real. The other, glass. Impossible to tell which one. Certainly the amount of warmth and kindness emanating offered no clue. He had a false leg as well, from the knee down, lost in an accident during his days as a deckhand. Being retired now, he was no longer licensed to operate, but he still had plenty of clout. It was said nobody got hired to any position of authority without Silas Buell signing off on it. His name was legendary on the river, venerated by some, but that must have been by people who didn't know him personally.
Oh, your test scores, Mr. Hardy, are impressive.
Thank you.
Many people are often clever at taking tests on paper. It doesn't mean much. Knowing the river is not the same as knowing what to do when you're on it. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
You ought to assume full responsibilities of captain on this trip. I want you to operate as if I'm not here. Your own fashion. Do as you would if you were the captain.
Yes, sir.
And not ask me questions, nor check with me about anything. Give your own orders. Make your own decisions. Live by them.
Yes, sir.
I understand your nephew is on board.
Yes, sir.
How old?
9, sir. He's well behaved.
See that he is. See that he keeps his life preserver on at all times.
I will.
Fine. I think you might consider giving the order to get us underway.
There. That's an example of how fouled up the whole chain of command was. On the one hand, he's telling me I'm the captain. On the other, he's giving me the order to give the order to get us underway. I should have said something right then and complained. Truth was, I was too intimidated.
Eugene? Willie?
Yeah, Captain?
Let's cut her loose. We're moving out.
Right, Captain.
Uncle Jeb?
Come on in, Luke. Eugene, as soon as we're loose, take the broom, sweep some of that assumed coal off the gunnel. Willie, I want an inspection of the air tank real soon, okay?
The air tanks were a necessity. Our tow consisted of 15 barges, five rows deep, three abreast, each with over 1,000 ton of coal. The double hull air pocket around each barge provided the extra displacement, which was necessary to accomplish the minor miracle of taking something weighing approximately 40 million pounds and actually floating it upon the water. Seepage into a hull could affect floatability as well as steerability. I also ordered it because I thought it would show the kind of attention to detail I thought Silas Buell would be looking for. Luke, this is Mr. Buell. Say hello.
Hello.
You keep that life preserver on at all times, Sonny.
He's right, Luke. Every moment. Unless you're in your room, up here, or in the galley.
I will, Uncle Jeb.
Okay, Captain.
All right. I steered us out, blending our movement with the current, which was light. There were a few bridges to pass under. I made sure I did them correctly. Silas was silent. Luke was taking his cue from me, and I wasn't saying much. You might think three people hadn't been together before might have some occasion to pass conversation, but there wasn't any. Anybody who's ever taken a driver's test for a car license knows why. The examiner is not supposed to converse. And you're not supposed to talk to him. He's to observe. You're there to prove you know what you're doing. Say, Willie.
Right here, Captain.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm new on this rig. I think I'm feeling some slackness out there. Maybe between 7 and 12. You want to check those wires?
Yeah, Captain.
Never say maybe to a subordinate, and don't say you don't know. Besides, you told him wrong. It's between 12 and 13.
I felt like reminding him the deal was no advice. Say, Willie.
Yeah, Captain.
When you're done there, check forward between 12 and 13, too, while you're at it.
Will do, Captain.
I kept my eye on the two faraway deckhands. One, which I judged to be Willie, broke off and made his way over between 7 and 12. The barges are numbered going out, like squares in hopscotch. When he was done there, he moved forward between 12 and 13. Through binoculars, I saw him using a cheater bar to ratchet tight the wires. All right, so I'd misjudged. Old Silas was already writing something down in his notebook, which I guessed wasn't a compliment. At least I noticed the slack to begin with. I deserve partial credit for that. Rapidly, this was turning into more of an ordeal than a test. Old vulture eye hovering behind me. Like in school, when your instructor hovers over your shoulder while you're writing down your answers. You find yourself thinking about what he's thinking. The result is, you come off a lot stiffer, a lot more awkward, less assured than if you were doing it under normal conditions. And this was going to go on for 5 days, possibly six. Already, I was feeling like the character in a Samuel Coleridge poem, except with the situations reversed. I was the poor albatross. He was the ancient mariner, hanging around my neck. Day, the best one. We had covered half our miles with 500 more to go. We had left the Missouri behind us, were halfway down the Mississippi within a few hours of turning up the Ohio. There was a beautiful sight before us. I prefer the forward watches when I'm piloting because you get to see both the sunrises and the sunsets. Right now, the sun was a golden orb shining down on top a thin layer of river fog. It was like looking down on clouds from an airplane. It was definitely going to be a good day. Almost certain because Silas Buell was out of the picture. Not feeling well was the report, so he hadn't shown up. Kind of beautiful, isn't it?
I can't wait to be up here when I get big.
Why? You're up here now, aren't you?
Yeah, but it's going to be better when I get bigger.
Tell you what, why don't you steer for a while?
What? Can I? Should I?
You don't need to worry about Mr. Buell. He's not feeling well. Go ahead. Just keep us on course.
What's wrong with him?
Stomach upset. He was complaining to Millie. Too much cayenne in the Cajun. Seemed okay to me.
He probably looked at himself in the mirror.
You think his acid personality gave him his sour stomach, huh?
It gave me one.
Well, maybe you're right. All right, you want to go a little more left. That's good. Nope, just wait. Don't overcorrect. It'll come around. Think of it like a needle on a compass. You have to give it time to pivot around its full. Be patient. Make your motion smooth. You're doing good already.
This is definitely what I want to be.
Yep. It's an ancient and honorable profession.
How old is it?
Oh, well, some people think it goes back about as far as the railroads, but it's much older than that. On this stretch of river right here, they used to tie together acres of rafts of lumber and float them down without any power at all. Just four long oars called sweeps, one on each corner to help steer around bends in the river.
So when did it start?
Well, now you're talking ancient times. You've heard of Cleopatra and her barge. You can even go back further. There was a big barge mentioned in the Bible, remember?
No.
Well, sure you do. They put two of every kind of animal in it.
You mean Noah's Ark, not Noah's barge, Uncle Jim.
Ark, barge, same thing. Go a little right now. Actually, if you're looking to discover the very first barge, you have to go all the way back to Adam and Eve. Adam was the one who invented the boat, you know.
He did?
That's good. Come back just a little bit. Hold it right there. Now you got it.
How did Adam invent the boat, Uncle Chip?
Oh. Well, it happened right after the notorious apple-eating goof-up. You remember that?
Yeah.
They'd just gotten kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And Adam didn't realize how much everything had changed. He was accustomed to all of the animals being docile and tame. So, when he went up to pet an adult Bengal tiger...
Uh-oh, Uncle Jeb, what do I do?
It's all right. You can move in a little more towards the near shore. He's going to stay over that way. That's the Mississippi Queen headed for St. Paul, I expect. We'll go by her in a minute. You'll have a good look.
Neat. What happened when he petted the tiger?
No, the tiger petted him back, leaving a row of claw marks down his back deep enough to plant corn in. So what do you think Adam did?
I don't know.
Well, he took off running, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I guess.
Except he came to a river. It was too wide. He didn't know how to swim, and it was right at this very moment that the entire history of the whole human race might never have been written. If it hadn't happened that a herd of water buffalo was swimming the river just downstream, Adam didn't wait. He used their backs as stepping stones and hopped across to safety. Afterwards, he thought this was pretty nifty. If every time he was being chased by a wild something, he could run down to the river and hop on a thing to get away. And that's how the boat got invented.
And then what happened?
Well, of course he had the basic concept, but he still had to experiment with materials. So he tried water buffaloes again, lashing 25 or 30 together by their horns, but he discovered that that kind of raft had a tendency to stray off or drown. Well, next, he tried rocks, which were plentiful and wouldn't stray off or drown, but rocks were hard to lash together and good only for short distances in very shallow water. It was just like inventing the wheel. He had to experiment with everything. But sooner or later, he got around to trying wood. The rest is history. From then on, the barging business really took off.
And then what?
Well, as I say, it took off. What then? Then the problem became, the problem got to be too popular. In a couple of centuries, the Egyptians were cutting trees, thousands of them every year, out of the Great Sahara Forest to make barges for the Nile. You know what became of the Great Sahara Forest. The problem was, they could only use a barge once. Once they floated it with their goods one time down the river, there was no way to get it back up again. Propulsion hadn't been invented.
What's propulsion?
Power. After a while, it was said there were so many abandoned barges floating about in the Mediterranean Sea, you could walk all the way from Egypt to Cyprus without getting your feet wet.
So then what?
Well, then eventually they had to come up with some means of propulsion, of course. There were a lot of experiments. There was one guy written about in the history books, Yamadi Fazuli, who almost came up with the idea of a sail barge. He studied the wind, you see, and he noticed that whenever there was wind, there were frequently clouds. And he figured,
clouds must attract the wind. So he had this idea. If he could make something that looked like a cloud and put it up, he could trick the wind into thinking it was a cloud, and the wind would blow around and blow his barge back up the river. He took a big piece of material, I think it was his tent, actually, and he sewed it on a framework and put the whole thing up in the air on a pole on his boat where the wind could see it. He waited for the wind, and sure enough, it came. But unfortunately, it worked too well because it blew his boat over and he drowned. So I guess that's an example of an idea ahead of his time. The Mississippi Queen. Nice old piece of history, isn't she? Back over. Always try to go the straightest line. Aim for that green marker on the far shore.
So then what?
Luke, give me a break.
No, come on. I'm interested.
So, then, the Egyptians, who liked to use slaves to solve their problems, had the idea of using slaves for propulsion. The idea was they would round up 40 or 50, tie a rope around the neck of each one and throw them all overboard with orders to swim ahead and pull the barge back upstream.
So then what?
Well, it worked. And the only problem was they had to have soldiers stationed along the rails with long sticks to push the slaves back in every time there was some silly rumor about crocodiles.
Were there crocodiles?
Well, sure. Of course, when it wasn't a rumor, they would just haul in whichever rope was loose and bring up a new replacement.
Ew!
Well, eventually, somebody discovered that by swirling those sticks around in a certain way, it would actually make the barge go forward. So they invited the slaves back on board and gave them the sticks. That's how oars got invented. That's also how the inboard engine came to replace the outboard.
Uncle Jeff, is any of this true?
Of course it is. Those Egyptians were smart inventors. Of course, not always they were. Those great pyramids were supposed to be luxury ocean liners. They had the same problem with the rocks that Adam did.
Rocks do not float, Uncle Jim.
Uh-huh. Is that right? What do you think we're pushing in front of us? We got as much weight as a respectable-sized pyramid. It's floating, isn't it? We passed through the big hairpin curves outside Cairo, Illinois, and then, rounding a final bend, came within sight of the confluence of the Ohio. I swung the helm hard over, and slowly our great length responded, coming around until our nose was pointing east-northeast, no longer south. First time on the trip, we were pushing upriver, not down, going against the current, not with it. The character of the river was changing, too. We were leaving behind the muddy Mississippi, encountering the greener waters of the Ohio, its color derived from the limestone and shale the river flows over. If the Mississippi is an old man river, then the Ohio is a young greenhorn. Like any adolescent, its youthful exuberance had to be restrained a bit. In this case, behind a series of locks and dams that managed to control its excesses. Most of the time it did. From here to Pittsburgh, there were 20 locks and dams. Between us and our final destination above Cincinnati, there were 8. I was fairly certain to be piloting through at least 4. Something I was not looking forward to, since guiding a quarter-mile-long tow into a lock chamber is always tricky. The equivalent of parallel parking on a driver's test. I knew old Silas would be watching and grading every one. I was glad to get 2 under my belt that day without him being around.
The fourth day was just as nice, weather-wise. Less so otherwise. There was an incident I should probably tell you about. The main drawback to that day compared to the day before was that Silas Buell had recovered. He had returned to the wheelhouse. No noticeable sweetening to his disposition. We were just passing Tell City, Indiana, coming up on the Cannelton Lock and Dam. I'd already steered us through two locks yesterday at Paducah, at Uniontown. At Paducah, I had scraped a little bit entering the lock chamber. Silas commented on my collision. He had noticed from his sick bed. He had noticed. Actually, it's pretty hard not to notice, since even the slightest touch sets off a chain reaction of shudders that travels the length of the toe. Same way a bump at the head of a freight train travels all the way to the caboose. It's oftentimes disconcerting to steer something this long from way at the back, but especially so when you're entering a lock. Imagine trying to park your car in the garage, and your front bumper is a quarter mile away. You can't see over the hood. You can't even see the end of the hood without binoculars. And it's a tight fit. 15 barges is the maximum you can lock through. 4 football fields. And definitely no room for the bleachers. Want to see what it's like? Try sliding your hand inside a glove without touching the insides. I asked Buell how he thought I had handled Uniontown, since I knew I had done that one flawlessly. He said he was sleeping. Probably kill the guy to ever say a complimentary word. I aimed a few more harmless remarks his way. He would shake his head or grunt or just walk out, reinforcing the notion I wasn't supposed to pay him any mind. Naturally, he could whenever he felt like it, but I couldn't. Truth was, I was getting fed up with his silly attitude. A more humorless man I never met. Never smiled. Probably couldn't. Probably if he did, his beak would fall off. Well, I decided if he was going to play his game on me, I'd play mine on him. I'd find some way to penetrate his hard shell and get down to the human being underneath. I awaited my opening. Cannelton Lockmaster, this is the Nancy M.
Nancy M, this is Cannelton. We'll be right with you, Jeff. Hold for clearance.
Thank you, sir.
How long do we wait, Uncle Jeff?
Just until that tow coming out now gets past us. Then it'll be our turn to ride out. Willie, how are we doing out there?
Right here, Jeff. Stand by.
Uncle Jeff?
Yeah?
There's one thing I don't get.
What's that?
That towboat passing us is pushing coal going that way. And we're doing the same thing, pushing coal going this way.
It doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't.
That's because there are two kinds of coal. What we're pushing up is western coal, low salt. The stuff going down is high salt. They mix the two together, so it burns cleaner and we don't have to breathe dirty air.
Oh, okay.
Silas Buell suddenly broke in.
All right, boy, now you answer me this.
What?
How come you don't see loaded grain barges going upriver, too?
I don't know.
Well, think about it.
I don't know.
Give me a guess!
I don't know.
Not very intelligent. Too little more inquisitive when I was your age. This is the breadbasket of the world, sonny boy. Don't you know that?
No.
Well, it is. Grain comes from all these farms. Farms way back you can't even see. It comes down to the river, and we transport it. Goes out and feeds the whole damn world. It's hard to pay more attention to what they teach you in school.
I saw my opening.
That's right, Luke. Grain almost always goes downriver. Not that we towboaters care a lick one way or the other, but the American farmer sure does. Yep. That's what got me into so much trouble that time.
What happened?
I knew that would hook him. Kids always want to know about trouble.
Nancy M, we're ready for you now. Come ahead.
Cannelton, thank you, sir.
What trouble was that, Uncle Jeff?
Well, here, Luke, why don't you handle the walkie-talkie? You relay my messages to Billy up front. Press here if you want to talk, otherwise keep the phone off.
Okay. What trouble was that, Uncle Jeff?
Jeez, that was the time I almost wrecked the boat. Old Silas was listening now, too, I was sure.
200 feet, Captain.
Tell him thank you.
Thank you, Captain says.
Who's this?
This is Luke.
Oh, hi, Luke. 150 feet, Captain.
What trouble was that, Uncle Jim?
Well, I was working for hire. Got hired to transport the first load of foreign wheat going upriver from New Orleans. I guess they hired me because they couldn't get anybody else to do it. The farmers up and down the river were hopping mad about it, talking threats.
I didn't take them too seriously.
75 feet, Captain.
Yes, I should have.
Why? What happened?
3 feet off the guide wall, Captain.
Tell him.
Captain says, thank you.
Lukey, how you doing? You're doing real good out there, getting yourself some good practice. You're going to be a pilot like Yoko someday.
Should I?
Go ahead, you can answer.
Thanks. I hope so.
50 feet off, Captain. 50 feet off the guide wall. 30 feet off, Captain. 25 feet. 20 feet, 1 foot off the wall. 15. 10 feet. 5 and a foot off the door. You're clear of the doors, Captain. Come ahead.
Like the camel's nose inside the tent, our nose was now slightly inside the lock chamber. Now for the rest of us to slide in. I hadn't bumped anything. The trickiest part over.
What happened in New Orleans?
Now, the farmers snuck on board night before we left. Pried off one of the hopper covers up front. Dumped in 100 sacks of sugar, 30 buckets of yeast. They pumped in Mississippi water from over the side.
What happened?
What happens when you add all that stuff to flour?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, it makes dough, don't it? The next day, traveling under a blazing sun that was really heating things up, the yeast began to ferment and incubate, hatch, and multiply. The next thing I heard was this big pop. Forward, I saw a hatch cover go flying, and this dough started rising up just like a blob.
300 feet off the front wall, Captain.
So thank you.
Captain says thank you. So, what happened?
Well, there wasn't much we could do to stop it. That hopper barge was nothing but a big bread tin. The sun was nothing but a brick oven.
250 feet off the front wall, Captain.
By noon, it had risen so much, I was having trouble seeing the steer. By noon 30, I was worried if we'd have enough clearance to make it under the bridges. The inside of the dough kept rising. The outside was baking into bread.
200 feet off the front wall.
Uncle Jeb, is any of this true?
Sure it is. I had to wake everybody up and put them all on double rations, but we couldn't keep up. I had to start throwing that bread overboard.
175 feet off the front wall, Captain.
That bread going over? Pretty soon, we had a flock of screaming seagulls behind us, like a swarm of locusts. The whole water off our wake was black with the backs of catfish sticking out.
100 feet, Captain.
They followed us all the way to St. Paul.
Come on, Uncle Jeb. None of this is true.
We were almost all the way in the lock chamber. Already the huge doors behind us were swinging closed.
50 feet, Captain.
Of course it's true. If it's not true, tell me, why are there Mississippi catfish in Minnesota? And how come you find seagulls in Iowa, where there's no sea around for 500 miles?
20 feet, Captain.
They've followed us up.
50. 10 feet, Captain. Kill them.
I looked at Silas. I was looking to see if he noticed how expertly I guided us in. Also, to see if I had penetrated his hard shell. He wouldn't look at me. But there was a smirk playing at the corners of his mouth, which I counted as a smile. So, I had won. I had cracked his mask. I hadn't gotten through to a human being, though. It was more like I unleashed a monster. I found out a humorless Silas Buell was 100 times better than one who thought he was being funny.
Sonny boy, call in.
Yes, sir.
Come, sir.
Yes, sir.
Kick me in the leg.
What?
Yeah, heard me. Kick me in the leg.
How come?
I can't ask questions. I can kick me. No, harder than that. Really do it.
I don't want to.
Boy, you do what I tell you.
Luke backed away, looking shocked. I'm not sure he got it was a plastic leg. The most horrible thing was Buell's appalling laugh. He watched for Luke to look his way again
When he did, he reached four fingers inside his mouth and pulled out his upper plate. Held it out. Luke's face couldn't hide his revulsion. This sent Buell into another gale of laughter at the boy's expense. Luke looked away. He didn't want to look again, but who could help it? When he did, old Silas was ready. Tipping his head back, he jammed his thumb up his eye socket, causing his glass eye to pop out so high he caught it with the same hand. Silas looked at the boy. He roared. Luke's lower lip trembled, his eyes pooling tears. Luke, why don't you go down to the galley, see what Millie's making us for dinner?
Okay, Uncle Jeff.
You know, Mr. Buell, that kind of humor might be fine for a grown man, but for a young boy, who's sensitive as he is, it's flat-out cruel. I don't think that was very funny.
Is that right? Well, is that right? Uh-huh.
Well, that really tore it. Probably stupid on my part to say something, but I didn't care. I felt better for it. Nightfall came on. The reflection of the water showing off the sky like the reflection off a chrome bumper. The dark hills growing darker. Shadows coming out from the riverbanks. Moving upriver is like pushing into the future. I looked ahead at the next few days, and all I thought I had to worry about were one or two more locks. If I had had any inkling of what really lay ahead, but thank God I didn't, I suppose. That's probably the reason the future is kept hidden from us, isn't that right? If we actually knew what disasters were coming up, pretty soon everything would shut down. After all, who would ride on a roller coaster, knowing on the next trip it was destined to jump the rails?